especially with television, the way people watch TV,
right.
the more natural you are, sure. the more convincing you'll be. It's not like giving a speech to 300 people. We have to project
just talk
sound. Just talk naturally. As if you were on your mm-hmm. audience. If they...
And the other obvious rule is the camera isn't here.
So right.
Peter
right.
and yourself.
Right.
All right. We have tape rolling, and anytime you'd like to start, Peter, cheers.
Well, I thought I was very impressed toward the conclusion of your talk about this description of the thesis of the PBS series being that our involvement was immoral from the beginning and that the defeat was inevitable. And I'd like you to kind of repeat that comment and
well,
then articulate your feelings.
What my feeling about the PBS series is that it has a woven thesis all the way through it that tries to persuade its watching audience and listening audience that somehow America's involvement in Vietnam was immoral from the outset and predestined for defeat, which is just the opposite of what was true, in my judgment, with Ho Chi Minh talking about freedom and independence. And where's the freedom and where's the independence in the communist slave camp in South Vietnam today? Just the opposite is what was really happening. And yet, after several years of being told this, on the American news night after night, I think it would be tragic if what goes down in the history books is that our involvement was immoral. Our involvement was not immoral. We were supporting our friends, and we were opposing our enemies. And what can be immoral about that?
Senator Sims, you spoke at some length, and I think very effectively, about the Case Church Amendment and the problems of that amendment and the effect on the war front.
Well, see, the amendment had a twofold effect.
Could you mention the Case Church?
The Case Church Amendment stated that there could clearly, unequivocally, in the law, said that there could be no American combat activity in or over Southeast Asia. And that was like sending a telegraph to the North Vietnamese that we were not going to enforce the Paris Peace Accords. When President Nixon engaged in the Paris Peace Accords and agreed to sign those accords, the understanding always was that we would enforce any violations of the treaty with American air power. Then Congress legislated that away from the presidency, took that power back into the Congress. That was an open invitation for the North Vietnamese to try a repeat of their failed offensive that they did, if you recall, an Easter offense in 1972. The North Vietnamese attacked with 14 divisions, 600 tanks, and the end result of that attack was, with American air support and the South Vietnamese soldiers doing all the fighting on the ground, they knocked out 400 of the 600 tanks and killed 100,000 of the North Vietnamese regular army troops, and then the rest of them limped home. So they won that battle and established and proved the fact that the South Vietnamese Army was finally trained after 10 years of American involvement. It was capable of carrying on the ground operations on their own. All they needed was American air power to support them, and the war would have been over. Now, otherwise, we would have had to give them adequate air power so they could do it. Congress didn't want to do that either. So, if you know, the Case Church Amendment was the invitation for the attack. Then, once the Case Church Amendment had passed, then what the Congress would have had to done to replace the Case Church Amendment would have been to move in several Phantom squadrons and maybe a few B-52s and train South Vietnamese how to use those so they could pick up the cudgel of the air power that the Americans had provided in pre to the passage of the Case Church Amendment. But see, neither was there. In addition to Case Church, then Congress started cutting the ammunition allocation, and so they literally left them without air power, air cover, and then reduced their tactical logistics supplies so that they didn't even have ammunition. His troops were going to the field with one hand grenade. Well, you're a former infantryman. You know that you send a Marine to the field or an American Army infantryman with one hand grenade where he expects to be engaged in a firefight, not going to be very happy. And that's exactly what was happening. So it's no wonder the outcome the way it was. And it was a very unfair to many of the very brave people who fought for South Vietnam's army. They were put in a psychological situation where the only end, they were put in a bad psychology and trapped. It's just a tragic story in history. And we are now paying for that very dearly. And our defense budgets today have to reflect more appropriations than we would have to affect if we had maintained our credibility at that point in time.
Well, as a follow-up, you related a personal anecdote about visiting the South Vietnamese Army in the field. Could you say something about what
yes,
you observed?
I visited the 22nd Infantry Division in South Vietnam up around the Trang, and they were just starting to come under attack as the treaty was being violated in the provinces. What happened was the North Vietnamese would take a province and wait and see if the Americans would react. The 22nd Division was under very able leadership of a very fine South Vietnamese officer, very well trained, well armed, under equipped in terms of tactical logistical supplies, short on ammunition, short on hand grenades, and many American congressmen had been there about 2 weeks before I was there. I think I was actually the last member of Congress to visit in the field, and I certainly was the last one to be in Cambodia. But they had been saying, and it was quoted around, that Congresswoman Abzug and others were saying, well, we're going to cut off the aid, there'll be no more American aid. Well, this really bothered the young South Vietnamese infantrymen, because they were savvy, they'd been used to having Americans around, they were reading the Stars and Stripes newspaper, and you know, they knew what was going on. And whenever they started hearing these stories that American aid is going to be cut off, it was very psychologically bad, and it put the field grade and the company grade officers in a real disadvantageous position to provide the kind of leadership that it was going to take to sustain victory in the field. And even at that, that 22nd Division fought very well until finally the roof caved in.
Senator, I think the last point we should address is the so-called Vietnam syndrome. And you mentioned seeing a bumper sticker that said El Salvador is Spanish for Vietnam. Could you talk a little bit about how PBS is applying the thesis of that series to other areas?
Well, you see, what's happening is that we have the same kind of a struggle taking place now in Central America. And the American people are getting a misinformation and a misbelief that the polls support this, that somehow the government that we're supporting in El Salvador is corrupt and a dictatorship and doesn't recognize human rights. Same thing exactly as what they all told us about South Vietnam, that the South Vietnamese government was corrupt, didn't have any recognition of human rights, and that the other side is popular. They would lead us to believe that the Sandinista government in Nicaragua, which won their election by a gun barrel, and they're the only political power they've had comes out of the barrel of a gun. They've had no elections. They have no respect for human rights. They've persecuted the Jews down there. They've been persecuting the Catholics. They've massacred many of the Mosquito Indians. And but we're not getting that side of the story. And the reason this is so critical, if the United States fails to meet its obligations in Central America, we will, in fact, have probably somewhere between 10 and 20 million refugees pouring across our borders from Mexico very rapidly, because this war that's going on in Central America, the target is Mexico. The target is not El Salvador. That's where the Soviets are trying to aim their arrow, is to stir up a problem on the border of the United States. So it's critical to our future security. And if we Americans fail to answer that call now to face our responsibilities, we will really have to pay for it in terms of terrorism, because we have right now today the PLO, East Germans, North Koreans, Cubans, and some Russians, thousands of Cubans incidentally in Nicaragua, are training people there in the art of terrorism. Why? So that they can infiltrate into the United States with these refugees, and then we'll have the war right here on our own front. Now, people look askance sometimes when you say that, but history tells us that that's what's happening, and the point that we need to make is that it is not inevitable that the communists are going to win. Communists have to be on the offense because their economic system fails. It does not produce the tools of prosperity, the food that people have to eat, the housing necessary. So then they go out and consume and gobble up another country and exploit its resources to offset the bad economy at home. So we need to be on the offense ideologically. And in order to do that, we here at home, we Americans, we have to know the truth of why we lost in Vietnam and face the sad, brutal truth and not make that same mistake again. it's going to take a lot of perseverance for us to be successful in Central America.
Could I ask you to swing back and just say one more time about why you're unhappy with the lessons which PBS teach, the analogy?
Well,
the reason
I think that the lesson from the PBS series is so bad for the history of the United States, it leaves a false impression that somehow when we were doing what was right, that is to support our friends in a moral cause, to oppose a tyrannical government which has no respect for human rights, for any kind of freedom, which massacred 2 out of 7 Cambodians and thousands of Vietnamese people, probably up towards 1 million by now, that have been massacred, that somehow they, the communists, were the good guys, and we, the Americans, were the bad guys. And that's not the way it was, and it should not be recorded in history that that's the way it is. And history must reflect an accurate portrayal of what really happened, and that was that we were in Vietnam for the right reason. There was nothing wrong with the reason. As General Bradley stated, it was the right war, at the right time, at the right place, against the right enemy. That was Omar Bradley's quote. And General Bradley understood what he was talking about. He understood the nature of the enemy. And I think it would be tragic if the next preceding generations of Americans somehow are led to believe that we were wrong by entering Vietnam. If they're led to believe that, and there's no political consensus to support otherwise, we'll make the same mistake in Central America. And if we make the same mistake in Central America, we're going to feel the price of failure much, much worse. I mean, there's no second place in a war, and there's no second place in national security. And freedom is something that's just not to be bargained with, and there can be no compromise. You know, had General Washington had the same attitude that's presented by the PBS series, he would have surrendered at Valley Forge, and we never would have achieved our independence and our freedom in this country. But the PBS series is the opposite of the installation of freedom and the respect for freedom and the responsibilities that go with freedom that were instilled in us, that we have inherited from the founding fathers of this country. It's the total opposite of that. It leaves one with a self that gives the impression it was a self-fulfilling prophecy that the communists will take over. And the same thing now in Central America, the relationship there is, it makes it appear to be a self-fulfilling prophecy that they'll take over. If you believe that, it surely will happen. If you recognize that we can, in fact, change the outcome of what's going to happen by exerting our responsibilities, it's just critical.
Senator, thank you.
Thank you.
Do you need any cutaway?
Yes, we do. Just okay. 2 more minutes, Senator. If you will.
Okay.
Here, just
sure.
Talk to the senator okay. So that we can get some shots
of Grant,
him reacting.
Would you go to the phone and just dial 9 to get out, dial 224-6191. Be sure there's not a boat on.
Excuse me. For transitions, they're going to take a few cutaways.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
I must say, I really enjoyed my visit to Boise.
Oh, that's great.
That was a lovely city.
It's the greatest place in the world to live.
Yeah.
Of all the cities in the world, if I was going to live in town, that's where I want to live.
Okay. No boat.
Good.
I thought it was a fine city.
You know,
toward Boise State.
Great jogging paths, you know,
up and down the river there. Yeah.
And people are able to tube in the river. Did you see that?
They were just getting ready to do that.
Uh-huh.
And I was fascinated by all the canals. I looked at a map before going up there, being a good Marine. You always make a map reconnaissance.
Right.
And saw all these canals. I couldn't figure out what they were for. So maybe it was for the timber industry.
Were you in 0302?
Yes, sir.
Great. Do you know Dave Sullivan, who works for me?
Do not.
Dave?
I knew a guy named Jim Judd, who was in my company and went the whole tour with me, James Judd. And he went to University of Idaho.
I think he's
a lawyer in your state now.
Yeah.
He told me he was going to go back and go into law.
You know, he's from Sandpoint, Idaho, I think.
Uh-huh.
Right. Well, yeah, I know his family.
Is he alive?
I've seen his dad and his uncle both, but I don't know whether I've seen Jim or not.
Jim Judd.
He'd be about your age?
Uh-huh.
What are you, about 40?
42?
42.
Mm-hmm. Well, my concern, like a lot of Vietnam veterans, you're worried about calling the family to see where the guy is because he might not be around anymore. And so I haven't, I've thought about it and just haven't called him. Jim Jett,
I'll have to see if I can track him.
Yeah, that was my only contact with Idaho and until the visit up there. But I love the state. My wife is from Oregon. And
my AA is a Marine, too.
Oh, really?
Sam Rouse, a tall, slim guy.
Really? Well, I'll be working with AIM for the next year. I hope I get a chance to meet you again.
Good.
Like you, I think you're doing an excellent job and a real service that the country needs. And we appreciate your help.
Thank you.
Did you get the release?
I'll go downstairs and we'll sign it on the way out.
Yeah, I'll be happy to sign it.